Welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on May 1st, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
Turning to our guest of honor, Ethan Hawke. Ethan received Oscar nominations both as an actor and as a screenwriter. If Wikipedia is to be believed, between his first film in 1985 and the four films he has coming out in 2018, he will have appeared in 69 movies. Ethan is also a movie director in his own right, both dramas and documentaries. He has published three novels, has appeared on stage in plays by Chekhov, George Bernard Shaw, and Tom Stoppard. He has directed for the stage, including the 2010 production of Sam Shepard's A Lie of the Mind. Needless to say, he has also appeared extensively on television. When Film Forum played Ethan's film, The Explorers, in our Film Forum Junior Series on a Sunday morning in 2016, he came and he answered questions from the audience, and this was all during a snowstorm, so that's pretty great. Ethan has embodied a vast array of characters. They've included an alien-obsessed schoolboy, the romantic partner of Julie Delpy in Richard Linklater's Wonderful Before trilogy, a modern-day Hamlet produced by Andy Fierberg, who might be here this evening, I'm not sure, a rookie cop, an Interpol agent, Ted Danson's son and Jack Lemmon's grandson, a vampire hematologist, a time traveler, a small-town drifter, and jazz great Chet Baker. In his spare time, Ethan Hawke is raising four children with Ryan Hawke in Brooklyn. If Brooklyn were not already so damn hip, it would be just because they live there. In my opinion, there are two things that make for a great actor: empathy and imagination. Ethan has both. His work in First Reformed is intense, conflicted, and sexy. Please welcome one of the nation's most prolific and versatile actors, in fact, one of this nation's greatest actors, Ethan Hawke.
That really was phenomenal. Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here. I want to let you have the experience of watching this movie. The only thing I want to say about it, I was thinking as I'm coming over here, that sometimes you have these moments where you feel like the way you've lived your life and what you've been doing prepares you for a moment that arrives, or you're not prepared for it. Sometimes that happens too. But I had an amazing experience of meeting, I'd met him before in passing, but Paul Schrader came up to me. He was giving Pavel Pavelkowski his award for best foreign film at the New York Film Critics, and I was presenting an award to Richard Linklater for Boyhood, and we were there the same year, and Schrader came over to me and said, "Hey, you know, I'm writing something. I have an idea. Can I send you something?" And I gave him my email, and about a year later, I got this script. And he said, "You know, I finished this and I'd really love it if you'd read it." And I read it that night, and I felt like my life had prepared me for this moment. To be, you know, I mean, that's what I do. I make movies. Other people, we, you know, do more important things. But this is what I do. And so I felt ready for it. I felt excited by it, thrilled by it. It was an amazing thing to get to work on as Trump was going through his inaugural address. And we were making this movie, and I think everybody on the set, cast and crew, felt we could put what was happening inside our chest and our hearts into this film that a lion has made, somebody whose whole life had prepared him for this right now. So I'd really love it if you guys would watch it, and after it's over, we'll talk about it, okay? It's an honor to be showing it to you, and I thank you for coming.
Great. Is that good?
Well, first of all, congratulations. This is an intense and intricate, very moving performance, but what an ending.
You want to talk about the ending?
Well, why don't we come back to the ending? But I want to start just by asking you about preparing for this role, because in your intro you had mentioned that you had met Paul Schrader when at the New York Film Critics, and this is the first time you're working with him. I think it's also the first time you're playing a priest.
Yeah.
And was there anything from your personal life that you brought to this role?
Well, my great-grandmother felt certain that my calling in life was to be an Episcopal minister when I was born. She felt very strongly that this was going to happen. And all the time as a kid, I was told about what the calling was, you know, and I just prayed that I never got the calling. I have been interested in religion my whole life. My mother is Episcopal, my father is born again, Church of Christ, and my stepfather was Catholic. And so I was raised in a pretty constant dialogue about it, and it's been a secret life of mine. You know, it's interesting, you know, it's funny to see a movie with Thomas Merton's name on the credits. There's something very moving seeing his name go up on there in the credits. And I often find myself wondering what Thomas Merton would say about where we are right now and what's happening, what he would think. For those of you who don't know, Thomas Merton was a great Catholic writer and thinker and a monk and who died in 1968. And he's a very fascinating thinker and not a Christian writer, really the most popular Catholic writer of his time, but never thought in a way that was obvious that you might think. Very, very profound thinker. And a real inspiration, I think, for Paul, and an inspiration for this character.
This is, Paul Schrader's been known, he's said himself that he's made a cycle of films about a man in a room, mm-hmm. you know, Taxi Driver and American Gigolo and Light Sleeper. Yeah. And this film seems to have a heavy influence from his own screenplay for Taxi Driver, but also, I think, Diary of a Country Priest is in there.
And Winter Light, Odette. Yeah. He has a... What's fun about working with Paul, you know, we live in a time period where it's so easy for people to cite cinema references or things like that, and they can kind of Google this, that, and that. He feels all this extremely intimately. You know, he wrote this amazing book, Transcendental Style in Film, when he was a young man, about religious filmmaking and about slow cinema and the idea of what cinema is when it's not trying to entertain you. And in our lifetime, cinema is an art form that has been completely usurped by big business. It's such a pleasing art form, you know, and it's translated into TV and it's in our home, but it has, you know, Winter Light was made a long time ago now, and there aren't a lot of movies that aspire to be like Winter Light. It's a Bergman's film, and you can watch it, and it's extremely provocative and intense film right now. And Bresson, you know, is a French director that was extremely exciting. But Bresson didn't have that much interest in acting. I mean, he had a relationship to it that was unique, but he didn't love it as an art form the way that Bergman did.
Right, Bergman, he used a lot of non-professional actors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you can use non-professional actors and still love acting. He really thought of an actor the way a painter thinks of a model. Do you know, like, they're a subject. And he didn't want you to participate in the artistry of it at all. Whereas Bergman had a lot of the same philosophies that Bresson did about filmmaking and what light and sound can do, but he also loved acting. Mm-hmm. And so I tried to focus more on the Bergman influences to this movie, just because I respect my own profession.
Let's talk about the ending, though. Mm-hmm. You were just telling me earlier something about the original script mm-hmm. of this film, and that he had shown it to another director.
Yeah, Paul. I hesitate to say this only because Paul doesn't like to say this, but so amongst us, you know, like Yeah, the original script I read was significantly darker, you know, and he
imagine.
He gave it to Scorsese, who said that this is dishonest. The ending of the movie is dishonest. You're so loving, Paul. Mm. You have so much loving. I don't think you believe this. I think you're scared of this, and I challenge you to come up with an ending that is more honest. Mm. And Paul really thought about it. And then the next draft I got, there was this insert of magic realism to the movie. You know, there's a scene where I love Paul says this. He goes, I just imitate what any film student would do and do what Tarkovsky would do. Have him levitate. And it's pretty awesome. But he put in a kind of a psychic element, an element of where our imaginations are. And because those scenes are connected.
I was going to say, they seem to parallel each other.
They're connected. Right? They prepare you for the ending. Mm-hmm. And the ending is, you know, it was an amazing experience to be on set with a grown-up who'd spent his life on film sets. And he doesn't feel he has a tremendous amount of time left. And he's very aware of that. And he wants to work. And he wants to say something and communicate something. And he worked on just exactly how much blood is on my, you know, is on my robes, and because it needed to be some, but not too much, because it needed to be both real and not real, both at the same time. That you know, the movie talks about hope and despair living side by side, and that he really aspired to find an ending that was both hopeful and weeping, and he believes that we have, as a community, have been incredibly cavalier with the planet, and that his own generation stands in shame about it. He often says this, that, you know, that they've put their own convenience and my generation too ahead of our children's future, and we've endangered everybody to be comfortable, and he's very angry about it. And he wants to make art about it, but that is not without hope. So, you know, that hope lives, and it's in this constant dance with absolute despair. And I think he feels all that really intimately, and it was fun to be on set with him. Fun is a weird word. It's meaningful to be on set with him as he worked all that out.
Yeah. And that last sequence, I mean, really does encapsulate that razor edge between hope and despair. And
it's really interesting. It's the first time you hear my character's name. You know, she walks in and says, Ernst, the strange name. And all this was very deliberate, you know. I mean, it's wonderful to be on set. You know, I've watched how advertising has influenced cinema. I've watched how, you know, we all have a phone now. Photography has just changed. What qualifies as an exciting image is changing. There's probably more photographs taken the last 5 years than the previous 100. And so our relationship to photography and cinema is changing. And so it was exciting to be there with a 70-year-old man who was trying to remind people about deliberate filmmaking. You know, it's just not a mistaken cut in this movie. It's amazing as an actor to be a lot as... I mean, he is amazing. I've never worked with a director like this. Is just, you'd finish a take and go, so is that the best you can do? But he's really serious. Is that the best you can do? Because if you can do something better, I'd love to see that. If you can't, let's move on. It's just really simple. It's kind of like, I've got about 5 more minutes to live, and so are we done? If we're not, then let's make time. Yeah. At first I was really thrown by it, and then later I'd be like, No, I can't do better. That's it. Nope, done. And he really just expects you to be a grown-up and say, is that the best you got?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't seem like there's an extra word in this screenplay. I mean, it's a beautifully spare screenplay, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to go to the audience. If you have a question, Just raise your hand, and we'll pass the microphone around. There's one right here in the second row.
I think I was struck just personally by the part where he was having the conversation with the husband, and he there was that discussion about how, you know, maybe I should have addressed him better, and maybe I could have resolved it better if I had talked to him a little bit different. And then I was thinking when he killed himself, I was thinking the priest was going to go through a little bit more heartache because he knew that, you know, he had a suicide vest. And so he should have known, anyone could have put two and two together, this guy's in serious danger of committing suicide, but he didn't immediately call the cops or do anything about that. I was thinking there was going to be a little bit more with that. Was that sort of internal, or did you feel like the story just decided to go a different way with that one?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that he becomes... I think there's a tremendous amount of self-loathing in that man and a tremendous amount of disappointment in himself. I mean, when he gets confronted by the, you know, what's it called? Begins with a B, Balk Industries guy who says, consider your own problems. It's a brutal thing. So you counseled him and then he killed himself and you're telling me what to do? You know, I mean, I think he feels horrible about it. I don't think he knows what to do about it. Except take on the kid's charge. You know, I mean, that's part of what's calling him. He wants to protect the wife. He wants to protect the young man. I think he's ill-equipped for the situation, you know? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess I don't exactly know what your question is, but I know that how I thought about it.
It seems like he almost was inflicted with a virus from
Michael. That's what Paul likes to think. Yeah. It's that he... In trying to counsel this young person, his own pain is revealed, that he's not actually qualified to help this young man because he's in a state of crisis. It's a beautifully written scene when I'm first counseling him. I mean, it's a really electrically written scene, very sophisticated. Nobody's right or wrong. But my character is in mourning for his own son and really hurting and not prepared to help another person. And he fails this person. I mean, I think Paul doesn't really see Reverend Toller as he's a failing man. He's dipping his breakfast of bread and whiskey and dinner of Pepto-Bismol and whiskey, and he's hurting. And he grabs on to the virus of depression as one of self-importance. And it's not that his cause, what I think is sophisticated about the movie is it's not making a case that you're supposed to be environmentalist. In fact, in a lot of ways, it's just the righteousness of that cause gives his depression purpose, you know, which is a very complicated idea and very true, happens all the time. You know, people who really suffer from depression find a cause to latch on, a righteous cause, but then go about it in an ill-fated way. You know, and it's so nothing's one thing. And I think we're really used to seeing stories that, like, this is what happens. This is what it is. A person does the right thing, they do the wrong thing, and you can feel good about who the character is because of that. I mean, isn't it fascinating? Because I won't tear up one page, and you see him tear up pages. I mean, he's just a human being. That's what he wanted to do. He wished he could have counseled the young man better. He probably is mad at himself about not helping him more.
There's a question right here in the aisle.
Yeah. Is it?
Yeah. Yeah, there you are.
Okay. And that was great. That was really fascinating is the right word. You know, today was a really beautiful day, and the only other really beautiful day in New York was in 2.5 weeks ago. I was in Prospect Park, and maybe you heard that news about a guy.
The lawyer who
auto-immolated and left all this, like, you know, attached it to this whole environmental, his history was kind of put out there. Did you find that, like, were you touched by that? Did you think that was a weird, cruel irony?
I was there about half an hour after he did that.
Me too, yeah.
Yeah, I was walking around the park, and, you know, I don't know what I think about that. I remember what my son said when he found my son 16. He said, it's just fascinating what each generation thinks. My son said he should have filmed it. It's kind of a dark thought and kind of a true thought. And you know that my son is growing up in the age of Instagram, and if you wanted to do something righteous, it's kind of what I was talking about when I just answered his question, is that sometimes that's depression, you know, that's what that is. It's depression attached to a righteous cause. I've had people in my family do the same thing, not burn themselves alive, but use causes to facilitate their own anxiety or depression, or attach it to that. And then everything gets really it's confusing, because they're both depressed and caring for something important, you know?
Yeah.
Another question. There's one right over here. I think that's Steve.
I'm an architect, and so maybe I saw the movie in my own special way, but I felt that I was so impressed by the austerity and the silence of those spaces, and it was for me, it was a character.
It is a character.
I was wondering if that was something you were in dialogue with, and it affected your performance.
You know, architecture is what film is made out of, a good script. When people say a script is good, they're talking about the architecture, the DNA of a film. And Transcendental Style in Film, Paul's book that he wrote when he was very young, is about what he calls slow cinema and the power of a silence and what it means when you hold a shot 2 seconds after the door closes and the exit. And you can, it's a strange thing, but, you know, molecules, people, we all make a big deal of what things are, but in truth, what is happening is the space between us and the relationship between each other. You are there and I am here, but neither one of us is really significant. There's an energy that's happening all the time, and that's what a great space, if you're an architect, right? I mean, that's when you're building a movie, you're building space, you're carving time, creating a relationship of time, and Paul is a student of that. If he were here, he would talk about Taxi Driver and Raging Bull and Light Sleeper and all that. And also, he wouldn't talk about those movies at all. He would talk about the movies he loves and how they use space. And he said to me when we first met on this, is there's a certain performance where a person entertains you. And there's another kind of performance where a person invites you. And he was saying, I need you to invite an internal experience. I can't have you ever entertain. We can't ever, if we entertain, people will realize how boring the movie is. You know, it has to be something else going on that is inviting you to see the relationship between things.
Yep.
You know? Mm-hmm. And so, the thing that I love, I use this word all the time, the thing I love about his script is its architecture.
Mm-hmm.
It's why it was actually really easy to edit. We finished shooting, he was done with the cut like 2 weeks later. The architecture, some movies you hear, we found it in the edit. He didn't find it in the edit. Sidney Lumet was the same way. You know, it's another generation's way of working. Sidney Lumet found the movie in rehearsal. I think Paul finds the movie writing it. He finds it in here. He's such a writer. But Sidney was an old-fashioned director, not a writer, and he would find it with the actors, and then he'd shoot it really fast, because he would say, they can take the movie away whenever they want. There's only one way to cut it, you know? But anyway, thanks for that question.
I want to add that the architect who just asked that question is Steve Tilley, who designed the theater you're sitting in.
Woo!
And designing the renovation
thank
and
you.
Our fourth
thank
screen.
You.
And thank you, Steve. More questions maybe in back?
Oh, we'll have to say hello.
I see, right, there's someone right on the aisle here, near the pillar.
Along the lines of the architecture thought, I'm just thinking of the scenes where, you know, you have the sparse architecture and then the connection between the two people, and that it's the closeness, I mean, where you're lying on the floor in this empty room and she's lying on top of you, and that's where this, those are the two moments in the movie where there's something active happening and it's all so internal at the same time. So it's just as Steve was talking about the architecture as being so important and the sparseness of the architecture, the quiet spaces, in contrast to those two moments where there's the, in some ways, the antithesis, the hopefulness.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things I know Paul likes to say is that that's where it's revealed that Reverend Toler is sick, when he holds hands with her. And there's this beautiful thing, whatever it is, whether it's fantasy, whatever it is, there's something beautiful that happens. He sees beauty in her, and love and hope in her pregnancy, and maybe he sees his child, maybe he sees his past, we don't know. But something beautiful has happened. And so it goes to this kind of fantasy of trees and waterfalls, and quickly gets toxic. You know, and it's not that the world is toxic. It's that that's the way he's seeing things, and he can't feel intimacy without quickly turning it dark, because there's all this beauty around us too, you know. And I think that's the dance of that last kiss. There's blood on his back. There isn't. It's good. He's saved. It's okay. No, it's a dream. No, it's dark. It's what, you know. And that's where we are. You know.
There's a question. Thank you. Well, you'd mentioned the Bergman, and I can understand wanting to do that. I was looking at the pieces that were thinking of the echoes that are in there, and Winterlight, as you probably know, they had the whole Bergman retrospective, and I saw the God and Man trilogy on one Sunday, awesome. One Sunday afternoon, so it's fresh in there. And also and what was guiding me is that the ending of that, of Winterlight, is essentially the show will go on in that. And here, as I was pondering whether the show is going on or what's going on, and I also found the weird echo of Leaning on the Everlasting Arms, which I don't think is the song in Night of the Hunter, but it has a similar name that is sung back and forth between Mitchum and Ms. Ray and Lillian Gish. And the point of that movie is the little things abide. They endure and they abide. Do you think there is a quality of redemption in this, or are we meant to think that it was the experience with Mary was wrong because they didn't have the joint? it was just the two of them, and they were close.
Well, what I see is that there's a person who's about to really give himself.
What is that sound?
This is about somebody's about to give themselves over to violence. What is important? Sounds like somebody's playing a video game on their phone.
You can turn off
loudspeaker.
I think you could turn off the wireless mics.
Okay. Yeah. He doesn't commit the act of violence because of her presence. Mm-hmm. And it's the only relationship we see him have. And it's that relationship that ultimately saves everybody else in the congregation. You know, and so there's, regardless of how you see exactly what happened there, something teetering on hope is happening. I mean, you know, a younger Paul Schrader would have me go in there and kill everybody.
Oh.
I mean, you know, for sure. And so there's that.
Okay. We have time for just a couple more questions. The one in the aisle, yes, with the jacket. If you can ask it in the mic. Thanks.
So one thing we haven't really talked about yet is your performance in this and what you said before the screening about how you sort of felt like you'd been when you read the script building up to this. And one of the things that struck me is, although this was significantly darker than a lot of your other performances, there were also a lot of similarities in sort of the complexity of character, of a lot of decisions that don't have a right answer. I think the whole Before trilogy is full of moments like that. Boyhood is full of that. Training Day, a lot of other roles as well. I wondered if you could talk a bit about how you felt like this was sort of an encapsulation of a lot of your performances before that, and if the darkness and the sort of the blend, the little glints of hope in this was sort of an evolution from everything before it, where even the Before trilogy is optimism sort of to reality as you go.
Well, thanks for that question. That's really kind and interesting question. I think that I am allergic to dualistic thinking, you know, and I have been since I was a young kid. Something's either this or that. It's always, what do you mean it's either this or that? Why? Life is so much richer than that, in that things operate on a scale and they operate in a moving, flowing, recycling manner. Life moves in more of a circle for me than some black or white, right or wrong. It's either this or that. I'm great, she stinks, she's great, I stink, he's terrible. You know, that's, we're always forced into this kind of dualistic thinking. You're either for this or you're against that. And life has always struck me as so much more complicated than that. And I kind of, I think part of the job of the arts is to communicate a holistic thinking. And I think it deepens us and forces us to be more compassionate, forces us, you know, that kind of dualistic thinking can be super comfortable, because it's really comfortable to be right and be mad at them because they're wrong or something like that. And it's much more uncomfortable. But one of the jobs of the arts is to make you see life. You know, we all see life from this tiny keyhole of our own experiences. And a great book, a great painting, a great dance, a great, you know, movie, it expands your vision. And if it's just as dualistic, then that's a big mistake, right? You know, and I think I love this movie. Why I was drawn to it is the religious guy isn't right. He's not wrong. The activist isn't right. He's not wrong. I mean, it's just so much more complex than that, you know? And it's what I love about it.
We have time for just one more question. Yes, over there. Yeah.
What was going on with his choice of which woman to reject and which woman to seek?
I mean, ask the universe. Don't ask me. You know, I mean, that's like, what's any of our choices? You know, it's so cool. I mean, one of my favorite moments in the movie is when he's just so absolutely horrible to the woman who really is nice to him, and then immediately afterwards says, "You know, I feel a lot better." Yeah, it's just the mystery of our behavior. You know, she feels sorry for him and wants to take care of him, and he doesn't want to be vulnerable. You know, and he wants to be young and a father again, and you know, so here's an angel. Oh, you know, I mean, it's just human behavior. You know, that's pretty much lifted straight out of Winter Light, you know, that complexity. And I just relate to it. You're a stumbling block. Isn't that what he says to her? You know, it's like, as if her point in life is to help him with his spiritual growth, and she's not helping. And so I just think it's when the character's asinine, you know, absolutely asinine. But with a little humility, you can relate to him a little bit.
Well, we can continue this conversation with Ethan over at Laley's. She is at 473 Broome Street in Green, second floor. So please join us.
And thanks for your patience. I know it's an intense movie, and I know it's hard to sit through a long Q&A. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ethan.
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcasts. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.